I'm Jeff Meyerson, and you're listening to the Quora Cast. My guest is Haseeb Qureshi, a former high-stakes poker player and now author of The Philosophy of Poker. I first met Haseeb when I was playing poker semi-professionally. I met him on a PokerStars table. We were both playing medium-high stakes. It was, you know, $1,000 buy-in game, so, you know, high enough that most other teenagers that were playing poker weren't playing that high of stakes. So I got to know him online, and then I got to know him in real life because, you know, we were both going to University of Texas and we were both studying philosophy, so we got to know each other pretty well. I eventually became disenchanted with the game. Haseeb got extremely good. He moved up to the highest stakes. So we kind of fell apart, but this was a great opportunity for us to kind of reconnect and catch up. And so he's got a pretty crazy story to tell. You know, he talks about winning hundreds of thousands of dollars, losing hundreds of thousands of dollars, both to playing and getting hacked. And he also talks about this crazy bet that he had with another player, this guy Ashton, and Ashton bet him that he could run 70 miles in 24 hours, and Haseeb wagered $300,000 that Ashton could not do this. And so it's a really interesting story, and I decided not to edit any of it out. So I hope you enjoy it. So Haseeb, welcome to the Quoracast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Haseeb is not actually, I should talk to you just directly, but, so you're not actually somebody who is,
a physical human being.
You're not a contributor to Quora.
Oh, no.
But I'm hoping that this will, you know, sort of, you know, maybe spur you or get some people to do, A2As, you know, get people asking you direct questions on Quora.
Okay.
And, you know, so I just wanted to kind of discuss, our past a little bit. And, you know, since you are basically, a poker expert, you've, you know, written a book on it, The Philosophy of Poker.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a lot of time with you when I was sort of in a pivotal situation in my life when I was playing poker.
Yeah.
You know, to kind of take me through, like, what was going on in your life when our paths crossed?
What was going on in my life? Well, I think I first met you soon after I came to UT Austin, which was, I guess I was 17. I just turned 18, I think, when I first matriculated to UT. And at that time, I was playing poker. I was a professional. I was playing, you know, probably 4 or 5 hours a day at that point. I was doing really well. I think I was like 5'10 or playing 10/20 at that time, which is $1,000.
There's no limit.
Yeah, no limit hold'em. And so I can't remember how exactly we met. I think maybe I messaged you online or something.
No, we were playing at a PokerStars table.
Oh, were we?
Yeah.
See, I don't remember at all.
We were both on like 5 tables at once.
Okay.
And, you know, you saw my location. It was Austin.
What it was, yeah.
You said something in chat. I responded. And, yeah.
And then how do we actually end up meeting?
I don't know. You know, we connected on Facebook
or
Gmail or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And then
I just remember this sort of, like, labyrinthine walk from, like, Jester, the dorm building.
Right.
And, like, just seeing, like, how shitty it was from the inside and be like, wow, people really live here?
Right.
Because, like, I remember I was living in Wittes, which is, like, much nicer.
Uh-huh.
I think I was like, was I living in Wittes? Whatever, around there.
Right.
But, I was like, holy shit, this place is like...
It's really dingy and crusty. And like, it's like an old cavernous mall.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember, you know, coming in and then seeing you with your 2 or 3 roommates. And I was like, oh, I guess this is what poker players are like. Because you were the first, you were actually the first poker player I'd ever met who like wasn't me. Or like just, you know, some guy who's randomly playing like, you know, penny games and wants to ask me questions.
Uh-huh.
You were the first like legit poker player I'd ever met. And so, you know, I kind of, you know, I came up in the game very isolated from other poker players or from poker culture in general.
Well, and same here. I mean, we both posted on 2+2, forum.
Right.
That's sort of where I cut my forum chops. Like, Quora has sort of become my, like, forum extension.
Sure.
But yeah, that it was the same experience for me, actually. It was like, you know, I had not interacted with a poker player in real life, like somebody that was also playing the games, you know, at kind of medium. We were playing, you know, pretty much the same stakes, mm-hmm. like kind of going through the same thing. Like you were about a year younger than me at the time.
Right.
But I guess you're still a year younger than me.
That's how that works. That's generally what happens.
Yeah. And, crazy stuff. Like, and I guess it seemed like, you know, neither of us really took, was taking school super seriously at that point. Like, right.
I mean, I was, when I first came to UT, I kind of imagined that like things would just change dramatically
right.
from how they were before.
Naturally.
You know? So I was going to, I was in an early college admissions program at Texas Academy of Math and Science in Denton, Texas.
Right.
And, you know, I was studying, my focus was on physics. And so I did a lot of, you know, early math and science stuff at a very young age.
Right.
And then when I came to UT, I was like, fuck all this. Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Certainly, yeah.
All right. I was like, screw all this. And what I really was passionate about was philosophy. And I realized that, like, as much as physics was interesting to me, to, like, read books about it and to think about it, actually sitting down and doing math problems at my desk for the rest of my life didn't seem that compelling of a way to, like, I couldn't be passionate about it, especially when poker was such a big part of my life.
Yeah.
And so, like, philosophy was the one thing that, like, I know this, to me, seems like it really matters.
Right.
So I went to UT Austin thinking that I was going to meet all these really cool people. I was going to have a lot of freedom, which I didn't really have in Denton. You know, I was underage
right.
at the time. And I was going to learn something that I really cared about. And none of that happened at all.
Right.
You know, like, it was the complete opposite. Is that, ironically, kind of at UT, I was more isolated because it's such a huge school. I mean, it's like 50,000 people in the school. And I was entering in as a junior.
Right.
You know? So, like, all of the, like, hey, welcome
despite
to...
Despite being, like, younger than
yeah.
some freshmen.
Yeah, I was 17 when I came in, and I was a junior, technically.
Right.
So no one held my hand or anything. It was just like, hey, well, you know, time to take some philosophy classes
yeah.
at UT. Didn't even have a car at the time. And I was completely isolated. And I was really depressed.
Right.
Like, I didn't enjoy my life. Poker was, like, the one outlet that, even if school felt pointless and
right.
kind of, like, unexciting, it was hard to feel passionate about
right.
it. You know, I was taking all these introduction philosophy
right.
classes and didn't know anyone in any of my courses and then, you know, just go home. And I would grind at poker. And poker was the thing that I really got a sense of progress and
fulfillment.
Growth. Right.
Yeah, it's amazing because that's you know, I know we didn't talk about it too much back then,
mm-hmm.
but that's exactly the same thing that I was going through.
Right.
But the way that I reacted to it was, I was like, you know, shit, like, this isn't how I want my life to look. I don't want poker to be the fulfillment, the focal point.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, like, self-destructed because of it because
right.
I couldn't, like... Your response was, this is the thing that I'm going to leverage and to make myself into something. My response was, shit, explode.
Yeah, I think the large part, like, if I had the capacity to explode, I would have. You know, like, I just don't think it was in me to do that. I think it was more like, if I didn't have poker, I have no idea what the fuck would have happened to me. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
It's kind of like, it gave me something to hold on to when I felt like nothing else was really worth
yeah.
pursuing or taking seriously.
Right.
And so the end result of that is I ended up becoming a really fucking good poker player.
Right.
At the expense of anything else.
Everything else,
yeah,
right.
Pretty much, yeah. So.
Do you think it's similar to maybe like what, like a college athlete? But I guess not, because a college athlete,
you know,
kind of gets built in socialization.
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. The social structure of like being an athlete, especially if you're doing like a team sport,
right.
is so fundamentally different from poker. Poker is, you know, sitting by yourself. Even if you're playing live, especially so, I think if you're playing live games, but even playing online, that gets magnified if you're, you know, a young guy living in a college town that doesn't have any other poker
right.
players except one, essentially, is that, like, you know, your experience of playing poker is sitting in front of your computer, hunched over your desk, clicking buttons madly for hours on end,
mm-hmm.
being awake till late hours in the night, you
mm-hmm.
know, sleeping poorly, eating poorly. It's not something that, you know, encourages any kind of... human social structure.
Right.
You know, it's very, very alien the way that you interact with the poker players.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's primarily like we talk about, you know, I used to have people who I talk hands with.
Right.
But there weren't really that many people. I mean, there were a couple eventually, but really when I first started playing poker, I mean, one thing was that I was getting so good so fast, right? I was going up in the ranks so quickly that a lot of the guys I ended up making friends with, I would just become so much better than them.
Yeah, you would just surpass them.
Exactly, I would surpass them so quickly.
Right.
That,
and that's kind of what happened with me and you, is
right.
I stagnated. Mm-hmm. At a certain level, I began to stagnate. It coincided, like, what coincided was I was realizing I didn't feel like I was quite as good as a lot of the other people, and at the same time, I started to realize that I didn't like the game to be the defining thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
And at that same moment, you surpassed me, and
mm-hmm.
you were on to, you know, playing, you know, 10-20 was your fallback game. 10-20
right.
was still my, like, you hop to 10-20 and take a shot game.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so you were up to like 25-50 and 5,100 and,
yeah.
and playing heads up in those games. And that was crazy.
I think a lot of it for me, so I started off the game playing 6-max, right? And that was the same game you played primarily. And I remember actually it was February of 2009, I want to say, maybe, whatever. And the thing was, I was playing 10-20 and I was getting really comfortable there. And I'd gotten to a place where I was really comfortable playing like four-handed and up, right? With four people sitting at a table or more. But when the game got down to heads up, when it got down to one-on-one, I was really uncomfortable against a lot of the players. And I felt like they were beating me. I felt like I didn't feel like I was as good as they were. And that really bothered me because I wanted to be like a really good all-around player.
Right.
And, you know, heads up is the best, you know, when you're playing blind on blind action, heads up is, the, you know, that's essentially what it is. So I remember I asked Strati. Do you remember Strati?
Yeah, he was the guy. He's probably beaten me for more money than anybody else.
Yeah, yeah. Strati used to be one of the guys. Like I remember all these guys I used to compete with
right.
when I was playing like 5'10". He
yeah.
was one of them, you know. And he ended up getting way better than me.
Right.
And he was like one of those guys who surpassed me, who I eventually surpassed later. But I always kind of felt like Strati was, you know, there are always those people you think are just like fundamentally
right,
better than you.
Right, and he's always acting so fast.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Like how is he even clicking that?
And like
fast?
He always like he just fucking knows. Like
yeah.
this guy just knows what to do. And the truth is, and the thing you don't realize, or at least I didn't realize until fairly late in my career, is that there's no such thing as that. Like that's complete bullshit.
Yeah.
There's nobody who's fundamentally, I mean,
right.
maybe if you're not, you know, if you're an old man and you're, you know, your brain isn't working as fast or whatever. Like but for guys who are smart enough, I think there's like a threshold of smart enough. And if you're smart enough, you can get as good as poker as anybody else. It's
mm-hmm.
all a matter of getting conditioned in the right way, talking poker with the right
it's
people.
It's heuristics.
Exactly. It's stumbling upon the right heuristics
yeah.
and developing them actively
yeah.
enough, right? So Strati, you know, he was a guy I just thought like, this guy's just
right.
another level. He's a beast.
Exactly.
And I remember I asked him like, man, what do you think I should do to get better? Because like, I just can't, I feel so uncomfortable when the games get shorthanded. And he said, well, you know, the really best players, you know, they, like, they're never fell in love with it, you know, in
yeah.
a way that I never did with six. Like, I liked 6-max, but that was poker,
uh-huh.
quote, unquote. That's what poker was. But when I came in heads up, like, it's so much more, you know, and I talk about this in that article that I wrote the other day in my blog. It's so much more warlike. It's just so gladiatorial,
yeah.
the way that you fight in a heads up game. It's just one-on-one, you and your opponent. And whoever outthinks the other player, like whoever is sharper, faster, who rises just one step on top, he's the guy who wins, fucking period,
mm-hmm.
right? There's nothing else you have to worry about, nothing else matters. It's the guy in front of you. Can you figure out the way his brain works faster than
right.
you can figure out yours?
Right.
And that is fucking fun.
Yeah.
Like, that is the most basic form of human competition, I think.
Right.
And so I really just got hooked on it. And, like, to me, that's what allowed me to, I think, really, if I wasn't playing heads up, I think it'd be much easier for me to get bored with poker a lot earlier than I did. But I think it's part of the reason why I started getting much better and better is because I loved heads up so much.
Right.
And it really, it was something that, like, I think it teaches you a different approach to poker than 6-max does,
yeah.
right? I think 6-max games, ring games in general, there's much more emphasis on technical.
Right.
Game, right. It's much more about figuring out the right frequencies and, you know, balance strategies and so on and so forth. Whereas in heads up, what matters much, much more is your ability to outwit people and to outthink them.
Right.
Which matters in 6-max, but it's not nearly as prevalent.
Right.
From a hand-to-hand basis.
Okay. So you're at this point in time, you know, you're you're what, like, I guess 18 at this point?
18,
and you're
19.
18
yeah.
or 19. You're kind of starting to beat, like, beat heads up, starting to kill heads up. So what happens next? Where do you go from there?
I have no idea. Where do I go from there? I eventually withdrew from school. You know, I started
right.
making videos for Deuces Cracked and Card Runners. I started
right.
coaching. I started teaching a lot of people how to play poker. And I did that in large part, one, because I enjoyed it. Two, because it actually ended up making me sort of refine a lot of my ideas about poker and think about poker better than I did previously. And
you also built a brand for yourself. You
I did, kind,
to build
of,
a brand.
Kind of inadvertently. I wasn't really intentionally trying to
sure.
do that. Yeah. And then I think the last part of it was really largely for my parents, because, you know, my parents are, you know, pretty conservative Muslims. And so, like, I remember the first time that I told them that I was playing poker professionally, I never told, they didn't know anything
yeah.
about me playing poker until I was 17. I started playing when I was 16. Until I was 17 and I made my first 100 grand.
Right.
And they, like, did not know how to take that.
Right.
Like, it's, and, you know, you can imagine.
I had the same conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
My dad was like, what, like, so, you gonna get a summer job? And I was like,
hold on, let me explain this to you again. Yeah. I don't think you understand what I just told you. Yeah. No, I mean, my dad was, my dad's reaction was just like, well, what? Really?
Yeah.
Are you sure it's real money? You know, and I'm just like, yeah, it's really real. Like, it's completely real. The other, you know, the other people actually made that money. And
yeah.
Like, they made it really, and then I really did it. So, but, you know, so my dad, and my mother especially, like, you know, they were kind of okay with it because they learned to trust me and they knew that, you know, they could trust my judgment. Like, I knew what the fuck I was doing. Which took a while for them to really understand because naturally I was really young and I'd never dealt with money before. But they came around to understanding that. But they were never really that comfortable with the idea of me making money just playing poker. And so when I told them about this whole coaching thing, they were like, oh, that's great. You should do more of that. You should do as much of that as you possibly
okay.
can. Because it seems like a real job that they can
right.
like, tell their friends.
There's
and
a
their
steady
family.
Income
exactly,
stream.
Exactly. It's a respectable kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, he's a coach. He teaches, he's a teacher. He teaches people. That's a very nice thing to say about yourself.
Right.
You know, so they like the nice thing. So I was like, all right, you know, I'll do that so that my parents feel good. And that's really a large part of the motivation. Was that for my parents.
For why you withdrew and
started. Yeah, why I withdrew from school, started focusing more
right.
on coaching and stuff like that.
Okay.
But also because, like, I was having a lot of trouble balancing stuff.
Yeah.
You know? Like, I just was losing motivation to go to classes. I really was getting disillusioned with the value of academia. You know, like, if you're making, you know, 300, 400K
right.
a year, you know, grinding on your laptop.
Yeah.
And then they want you to, you know, come in 3 days a week and do, like, 300-page
right.
reading assignments on ancient Chinese philosophy.
Yeah.
Which don't ever, like, you know, have no applicability, so I can eventually get a piece of paper that's going to be worth
yeah.
nothing. I was just like, no. Like, I don't buy into this. Like, as much as I'm passionate about philosophy, I can read philosophy on my own. You
mm-hmm.
know, I don't need to have to take credits and do this whole, you know, go through the whole circus.
So, okay, so you withdraw from school.
Yeah.
Did you feel happier at that point? Like, did your life start to come into focus?
No, not at all. Like, if anything, it made it even worse, because then I didn't have that, you know, the thing is, I threw myself into poker, right? Poker was sort of my Sisyphean task, was to get better and better at poker without having any idea of what was supposed to come at the end of it, you know? I gave up that idea, I think, at a certain point, that there was supposed to be something at the end. Because I kind of knew that. I remember I once wrote an article. I never published it because I didn't like it. But it was an article talking about why so many top poker players seem to be so dissatisfied with their success or with life, even, you know, or with poker. And I think a big part of the reason is, you know, and this is, in a way, it's like one of the oldest stories in human culture, is that getting to the end of a journey, or getting to the end, getting a goal, getting a thing that you think is going to be the thing that ends it all, making $1 million or beating this guy or getting to, you know, 200, 400, right? All of that is empty when you get there, right? It's just, once you get there,
it's always the journey, not the destination.
Exactly. It's just where, when you get there, it's just where you are. You're just, when you get to the top of the mountain, you're just there now.
Yeah.
And you're just standing there. And then you, there's nothing else for you to go up now. Right? you're done with this mountain. Like, there's no more mountain to climb.
Yep.
And when I really, really come to understand that, like, when I first started playing poker, my dream was to play 1-2. $1, yeah. $2. That was my dream, which requires a bankroll.
You just free-rolled your way, right?
Yeah, I started with $50 that I got for free.
Right.
That wasn't even in my name.
Yeah.
And I built that up.
Exactly.
Never deposited.
Yeah.
Because I was underage and I couldn't.
Right.
And my brother wouldn't agree to put me. He wouldn't agree to put any money on for me, so I had to do it myself with a fake account. But my dream was to play 1-2, which, you know, requires $8,000.
Right.
And I did not know if I would ever accomplish that goal.
Yeah.
And when I did, I was like, okay, well, 1-2, what was I thinking, right?
Yeah, super
10-20.
Easy.
It should
be
10-20. That's the goal. That's the real goal. That's what, you know, when I was first started playing poker, like guys like, you know, Hallengall.
Yeah,
Reckle,
exactly.
And like those guys, they were playing 10-20. That was the highest games on Stars at that time.
Bold sweaters.
Yeah, building sweaters, yeah. Exactly. I was like, yeah, I want to build sweaters. I want to be like him.
Yeah.
And fucking, like, I got there and I was like, well, 10-20 was obviously not the top now. By the time I got in 10-20, they'd made higher stakes games.
Right.
They made these, you know, what we started calling nosebleed games.
Right.
Like, you know, 100, 200, 200, 400 that required 20K, 40K, 60K buy-ins.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, that's the thing. That's where I got to go. And, you know, eventually I was playing 500, 1K heads up with Gus Hansen.
Right.
And when I got there, I was just like, well, fucking... Like, now I'm just here now, you know, like that's just, it's still poker, it's
and
still
it,
just playing guys,
yeah,
so just, you know, finding fish to play, it's
exactly.
still game selecting, it's
still the same thing,
the same fucking shit,
yeah,
and not like it doesn't change, like
it
doesn't get better, it doesn't
no.
get more, it doesn't get more interesting when you get to the top,
yep,
if anything it gets less,
mm-hmm.
it gets much, much less interesting,
yep,
and I remember the one really pivotal moment for me, when I first started playing poker, I really looked up to two guys. Green Plastic, Taylor Cabey,
mm-hmm.
and Mahatma.
Right.
Claude Friedman.
Sure.
And Mahatma was really the guy who I thought was better, but everybody kind of had like a side, right? There was sort of.
Well, because he did this crazy like overbet shit.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're like, what's he doing with the overbet?
Overbet?
Like, how's he calculate that?
How's that possible? You know, like, nobody overbets. Like,
right.
Only fish overbet.
Right.
That's a fish move.
Yeah.
You know, and of course now everybody's doing it.
Yeah.
But like, he was just, like, to me, Mahatma was just like this kind of foreign.
Yeah.
Fucking
he's got like a mind
power,
like a mind,
you know?
Force.
Exactly.
It's not a person, it's
right.
a mind force.
Exactly. Like he's just a force that pushes on the poker and lets him know, like, none of you mortals can ever be as good as this
right.
game as my disembodied self. And so I remember, like, Taylor Cabey, he had like basically quit poker by the time that I got up to his stakes. You know, he was just basically
right.
became a business.
He's
so.
Just like chilling.
Right, exactly. So he went out
suit
of the race.
And tie.
I played him at a certain point and I beat him really easily because, you know,
yeah.
he was just not keeping up with poker. And so I was like, okay, well, that doesn't really count, right?
Yeah.
But I remember I played this 5100 match against Mahatma, Claude Friedman. And I was like, this guy was my idol coming
right.
into the game. And I was like, there's no way I'm going to be able to beat this guy.
Right.
right? Like, I've been knocking heads
right.
at 5100, 2550 for
right.
a while now. But Mahatma, I was like, no way. This
right.
guy. This guy's a beast.
So did you go to his home state? Oh, did you go to UB? Did you play him on UB?
No, I played him on Fultilla.
Oh, okay, thank God.
Yeah. No.
You can't beat him on UB.
I probably not. He's probably got some special. They probably put some failsafe in the program if
right.
he can't lose.
So this is internet pokers playing against.
Yeah, playing against Mahatma,
right.
Claude Friedman. It was Spirit Rock. That was his name.
Spirit Rock.
Yeah.
yeah.
I think actually you saw me play some of the matches against him.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, yeah. And. The really bizarre thing was that I just crushed him. Like, he didn't stand a chance. And
was he making, like, fundamentally
he was just,
bad mistakes?
Like, I just knew every time he was bluffing.
Right.
I called down all of his bluffs.
Right.
I just he couldn't fold hands
yeah.
to me. And I just, like, I crushed him for, like, 9 or 10 buy-ins.
Right.
Busted his account. And he didn't play me again.
And you gave yourself an existential crisis.
Kind of. Yeah. I mean, I did play him again later at PLO, but then I didn't really. He was not very good at PLO, and PLO is more of like a very back and forth, so it doesn't really feel as solid as
right.
beating someone at no limit.
Right.
You know? But like after beating him, and he, you know, he just refused at me action anymore.
Right.
And I was like, "Fuck, now what?"
Right.
You know, like he was the guy. He was the fucking guy, and then I just beat him, and I feel nothing. I feel no. Like, I feel like a badass for, like, 20 minutes.
Sure.
And then 20 minutes pass, and it's just like, well, shit. You know? I guess I'm better than Pralad Friedman now, but I don't feel anything about that. Like, that's
yeah.
not a... I'm better than a lot of people.
Yeah.
Fucking... Yeah, that's kind of where I got to. I got to this point where it's just like, I don't know what I'm supposed to care about.
And so where do you go from there? What happened next?
You go down. You go way down. You go.
Oh, so this is like Gus versus Gus, when you lost a bunch versus Gus, right?
No, because I lost. I won versus Gus. I won total versus Gus. I ended up losing. So I went on a downswing when I started playing PLO. I started playing PLO because people stopped playing me at No Limit.
Okay.
Like, basically, people would not play me. My name has sort of gotten so big. And that was partially my own fault because I was, like, making videos.
Well, it was always kind of big because it was in all caps.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And the penguin, like, it's a big avatar, right? It takes up a lot of space. But, yeah, it became bigger. People wouldn't play me. And I'd sit at No Limit tables and no one would, you know, I'd sit with other people. No one would play me.
Which is, of course, a harbinger to what poker is now.
Right,
playing anybody.
Nobody playing anybody, yeah. But that, I eventually was like, okay, I'm not even playing poker. You know, I'm just essentially waiting for frustrated regulars playing lower stakes to take shots at me, or random fish to sit down.
Right.
And that just didn't happen that often. And so I started playing PLO. And PLO, I ended up getting very good at heads-up PLO very quickly, because heads-up PLO is very...
you can extrapolate the stuff from No Limit.
Exactly, though. A lot of similarities. So I got really good at it pretty fast, but PLO is such a crazy... You know, very high...
Swingy, high variance,
exactly. And so I went on a really big downswing, and then... But that wasn't...
Did you play 501K PLO?
No. Well, I was playing against Gus Hansen.
Okay.
That's where I was playing.
Because that's such a good spot.
Yeah, because it was such a good spot. But, yeah, I was playing... I was playing most of the nosebleeds, I think, PLO. But, like, I went on a really bad downswing. I was kind of losing... I was just getting really frustrated with poker. And that's when I got... I played Isildur.
Oh, you played Isildur?
Yeah, you don't remember that?
No. Was this after he... no, I don't.
No. This was before his matches with Durr.
Okay.
And, Patrick Antonius.
Right.
That. So I was like one of the... I was like a third...
Is Isildur the best player now? Is he like renowned? Do people...
I don't think people think he's the best.
Right, Phil.
He's
alive.
Very good.
Okay, so he's like top three probably.
I don't know about top three. I'd say top 15 for sure.
Okay, top 15.
But there are definitely people who I think... The thing about Isildur is he's still pretty tilty.
And right.
He plays a lot of games that he shouldn't be playing still. He's definitely gotten a lot better, but I would say. But again, like, I'm not an expert anymore.
Okay,
I wouldn't, I wouldn't deign to rank people
who
haven't even played or know very much about. So, but anyway, so I was the third person, I think, who played Isildur, and he won a ton off me. But he ran, like, really, really well. So I think my all-in EV, like, basically, if I ran an expectation, I would have lost about 100K. I ended up losing about 600K. So I ran.
Okay.
You remember
now? I was trying to remember when you had the huge fucking losing session.
Yeah, that was in 2010.
And that so that was Isildur?
Yeah, that was Isildur.
Okay.
Yeah. And then he played Jungle Man. He smashed Jungle Man. Then he played Patrick Antonius, smashed Antonius, and then he played Durr.
For like a really long time.
Crazy.
Just like killed Durr. And then finally Stinger killed him for $4 million.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. Stinger with all the crazy crap that happened after that, with people getting mad at them for...
Because they... Like, Townsend, Stinger had everybody's hands, right?
Yeah. Basically, Townsend and Cole South had been, like, swapping hands and stuff. Which, again, I don't even want to comment on that, because it was years ago. And, like, it was one of those things that, like, high-stakes players or, like, poker players are like, dude, there's nothing wrong with, like, that's totally...
Yeah.
Who fucking cares?
Yeah.
Like, you know, Isildur can do the same thing.
Yeah.
Like... Everybody has access to hands.
Yeah.
It's a public, like, you can get them anywhere.
No, that's how I feel,
Yeah, but, like, people are like, well, no, fucking, because they, you know, poker is such an interesting little petri dish of the way ethics evolve. I've always found that really
interesting. It is.
The way that norms change based on economics, based on, like...
Envy.
Envy, yeah, and just kind of based on random cultural moments, you know, which I guess is the same thing that you see in... You know, legislatures, right? Like, laws get passed because one person gets some freak accident happens to them.
Yes.
So now it's illegal for XYZ thing to happen. Right?
And just like you were telling me earlier with, you know, as the easy money in the game has contracted, the ethics in the game have gotten, like, really, really sketchy. Like, it's harder to rely on, you know, staking somebody for a tournament because they might just welch and, like,
take
off with the money.
Yeah, exactly. Basically,
they're willing to stake their reputation. Like, reputation used to be the thing that you avoid fucking up because your reputation is how you get insane credit in the poker world.
Right.
That's why you can get somebody to lend you 100K for no fucking reason, mm-hmm. other than you're the guy, you know. And now, you know, it really says something about how much the poker economy has contracted that people are willing to risk their reputation.
Right, because their reputations are, in economic terms, they're worth less, right? If the poker market has contracted.
Right.
Like, because essentially your reputation is, if you think about it as like a value function, it's the value of your reputation for every single day that you're going to continue to play poker,
yes.
and how much money you're going to make based on that reputation.
Right.
If poker is just, you know, if poker is contracting like a, you know, grimy little washcloth,
right.
it's not going to be worth much in 10 years,
yeah.
then it economically makes sense to you to not value your reputation as highly.
Right.
So, and that's kind of what people see is that it used to be that people, like the checks that people would put on potential stakies or people to lend money to were much, much lower 5 years ago than they are now.
Right.
For that exact reason is that people.
Because the money was so good.
Exactly. Exactly. So many more people were good stakes.
Right.
And
so, okay.
The risk of default was much lower.
So moving forward with your own economic contraction, what happened after the 600K bender?
After that. Really, actually, that wasn't nearly as bad as what happened after that. What happened after that is that I ended up getting hacked, and I remember I was playing PLO for about a month through this process, and I had no idea what was going on. I was losing. You know, I lost Easel there, and that was like a thing. But that was like a freak day at high stakes, you know. And I knew I'd run really under EV, and I was like, okay, but I'm still a good player, you know. And I remember constantly like asking people. Like other really good players, like, hey, I'm losing. Do you think I'm good? Like, I need.
Right.
Like, I didn't say it like that, but, you know, I needed.
I totally. I remember going through that on my big downswing before I quit.
Yeah.
I was like, was I running good the whole time?
Right, exactly.
Am I actually good?
Like, what's going on? Like,
do I actually have value as a human being?
Are you lying to me? Like,
yeah.
You can tell me. It's okay.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to get mad at you. But, like, you know, no one.
You know what? Just tell me I'm shit.
Yeah.
That's what I want to hear. I'm
just say
shit.
It. Just want to say it. You don't have to mean it. Just say it. No. So I was playing these guys, and it was a few names. I don't remember them. It's like Big Blue Bonsai or something, whatever was the name of one of them. I don't know why that's funny, but I kind of get it. But I was playing these guys, and I was just getting smashed. But my EV was not showing it. Like, I was dying at the table in an EV, and I was just like, okay, not only am I losing, but apparently I should be losing.
Wait, so you said you got hacked. How much did you get hacked for? Or are you getting to there?
I'm getting there. Yeah, so basically, over a month, I was playing these random guys. And occasionally I'd play against somebody who would just destroy me.
Okay.
Right? And they would just take tons and tons of money off me. And I was like, I don't think this guy's that good. Like, I can see fundamentally the structure of his game. Like, he doesn't seem that much better than me. Like, this Big Blue Bonsai guy, though, here's the thing. He didn't seem that much better than me, but he was beating me. And I was like, all right, this is...
What was his avatar?
I don't remember. Maybe the car? I think it might have been the car. But like, yeah.
So this is full tilt.
This is full tilt, yeah. So he beat me. And then the nail in the coffin was I was playing this guy at 10:20 Euro on a Euro site.
Okay.
And this dude was one of the worst fish I'd ever seen.
Right.
Like, he was completely clueless on the fundamentals of poker.
Oh, shit.
And he was making plays that no human being would ever make.
Right.
Like, he would just reshove on me in spots where, like, how the fuck could he know I'm bluffing? Like, he would have to call everything here.
Right.
Or he would just, like, he would just make play, and I would see him, like, call me down with, like, one pair.
So this was a keylogger. You were keylogged.
No. It wasn't keylogging. What actually, so after that, I was like, I showed the hand to somebody, and they were like, man, that looks really fishy. And I was like, I know. Like, you fucking, like, this guy, I know something is going on.
Yeah.
This guy, like, the other guy, I was, like, suspicious. This guy, I know enough about poker to know this is not real. This
right.
is not right.
Yeah.
Something is fucked up here.
Yeah.
So what I did is I found this guy who was a networking expert. He scanned my ports on my computer and found, like, basically a port that was open that was shoveling information to some computer with an IP in Sweden. And using something, I don't know actually how he did this, but he I don't know shit about, you know, networking or whatever, but he basically was able to pull up the screensaver of that computer. I don't know how, but, like, I could see I saw the fucking, like, welcome
you
to Windows.
You mean, like, screen share? Or
yeah, like that. Like, the welcome screen in Swedish. Like, the name, like, welcome to Windows, right?
Oh, he could see that guy's computer through yours.
He could see that my computer through mine. I don't know how the fuck he did that, but, like, and when I saw that, I was like, what the fuck, right? Like, that was, like, the moment that was, like, holy shit.
So you don't even know how much you lost through all this hacking.
I'm pretty sure, because I know at least those two names.
Okay.
And so I'm pretty sure it was about 200K. If it was just those two names. And I believe it was, because later people found, like, they actually knew the names of these guys because they hacked a number of people.
Right.
There was, like, this Swedish hacking ring that attacked a number of named pros, and they, like, tried to do some shit about it. And I don't think anything ever came of it.
But, yeah. That's not surprising. So how did you get this? You have any idea how you got this on your computer?
I think it was actually through IRC. That's what I was going to guess.
What?
Because I used to go on IRC in the Mid-Stakes NL channel, and I would, like, talk to people there, sometimes talk about hands and stuff. And, you know, you can see your IP from there.
And,
right, because
okay.
IRC, yeah.
So it wasn't like some guy was like, hey, check out this EXE file.
No, because I remember ever doing it. I was pretty, you know, because I've been hacked a number of times, right? But it was always small. It was always small fry stuff, like getting my AIM hacked, getting my Skype hacked.
Uh-huh.
And you know, like when you look at your poker account name, you know, because I had hundreds of thousands in my account, you can look at it and you can actually see all the login attempts.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, people were trying to
You're
log into my account all
getting
the time.
Pinged.
Yeah, all
yeah.
the time. People are always trying to log into my account.
Yeah.
And you know, I have a very secure password, so I'm not really worried about it. But like an online poker player is a very high profile target for hacking.
Yeah.
So I've been kind of used to that. So I don't click, you know, I don't fucking install shit
yeah.
that I get from people. I'm relatively thoughtful about
yeah.
the porn I watch. You know, like I try to, you know, I keep it together. But IRC, that's the only thing that I could think of that somebody would know my IP and then be able to do all that shit.
Yeah.
I don't know ultimately how it was done, but it was done. So after that, like But the thing is, the emotion that I felt after that was overwhelming relief. Because I was like, oh, so this
right.
wasn't my fault.
Right,
right,
okay.
It wasn't, I wasn't bad.
Right, okay,
I've been
sure,
hacked.
Sure.
And so this isn't part of the game,
yeah.
right? This doesn't count. This is like my bank going under.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's what that's like.
Exactly.
It's not my fault. I didn't
Definitely.
Fuck up. I'm not
Definitely.
A bad poker player. So I was enormously relieved in a kind of fucked up way. And but I was also really just fed up with poker.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, fuck this game.
Yeah.
After all this, like, I think I deserve a fucking break. So I had to, you know, pull the plug on my computer because I was terrified by the fact that some Swedish group of people were seeing
yeah.
everything that I was doing.
Yeah.
And so I pulled the plug on my PC and I ended up coming down with a flu around then. And so I didn't play any poker for like a month
uh-huh.
because I had to, you know, clean up my computer and get it all going again. And so when I recovered from the flu, I decided that I was going to take a break for a while because I was just kind of... Around that time, I had realized that I really had lost a lot of my love for the game.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something I've been struggling with for a long time.
Yeah.
And I remember a lot of my poker friends who I tell this about, they would talk me into continuing to play.
Yeah.
And I would be looking for reasons to quit, right? I remember like buying books on real estate and trading and
yeah.
stuff like that, like ways that I could get out and feel like I'm going into something else.
What about the piano lessons?
The piano, I think I started that when I was 18, and then I just totally fell off.
Okay, I just
yeah.
remember you playing piano, and I was like, is this maybe, I don't know.
No, that was more like me feeling guilty for never having indulged any kind
okay.
of musical training.
Right.
Because, like, I mean, that's one thing that I still regret, is that I didn't even keep up with the piano thing, which I started
yeah.
again when I was 18. I still own a piano.
Yeah.
But don't have played in years.
Right.
It's probably horribly out of tune. But, yeah, like, I remember feeling... Like, I was just I didn't feel passionate about poker anymore. You know, I didn't love it. And I wished that I could do something else. But I knew, in a way, like, I was kind of a slave to my own success.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, poker had made me so rational that
yeah.
I couldn't justify to myself.
Was it strictly the opportunity cost of potentially not playing poker? Or was there any of it, like... you know, I don't have anything else to go to. Like, there's nothing else that I have that I can be doing.
I think there's no way that wasn't part of it.
Right.
But it was primarily, like, what really kept me coming back was this idea that, like, when I'm 35, how much am I going to regret that I didn't take advantage of this and,
yeah.
you know, make the millions that I could when I had the chance, right?
Right?
Like,
so you knew even then it was a fleeting market.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think most people were aware of that, at least intellectually.
Yeah.
You know, even if they didn't act that way.
Right.
So
the people that were, you know, convincing you, they were like, it's not going to be this way the whole time.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Like, when you step out of it, like, your value as a poker player starts to plummet. Right?
Oh,
yeah,
so quickly.
And you start getting out of practice.
Yeah.
Your ability to make really good money just goes out the window if you're not playing consistently.
Yeah.
So, but I ended up taking a break, and, you know, I went back to school, and my plan was to come back in a few months, just kind of give myself a breather, finish these classes, and, you know.
This is after the flu. You hadn't come back and played at all. You were just like, eh.
Yeah, yeah. And so after like a few months, I was like, all right, time to play again. I played for about like a couple days, and then I was like, well, maybe I'll wait a little bit longer. And then like a month later, I tried again, didn't stick. I tried again a month later, and I just like, I realized that I was not able to get back into the habit of playing poker because I just didn't want to.
Yeah.
Like I genuinely did not want to. And that started to become the defining struggle for me, was that I didn't enjoy playing
this
poker.
This is 2012?
No. This is 2010.
2010. Okay.
Yeah. So these sort of things happened in 2009. This is 2010.
Okay.
And so what ended up happening is that...
Has the running bet happened yet?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. That happens in early 2011.
Right.
Yeah. So then in 2010... I ended up going to Vegas. I'm 20 at the time. I ended up going to Vegas for the first time, meeting a lot of poker guys who I'd never met before. I ended up making friends with Ashton, Jungleman, a few other guys who I knew. And Jungleman and I end up talking about potentially living together. Because I never lived with a poker player before. And I kind of thought, because I was having so much trouble getting motivated to play poker, I thought that maybe this is the thing that'll save me, right? If I live with other poker players, you know, the grinding energy will just be infectious, and I'll like get back into it, and I'll find that culture again, and everything will be good.
And Jungleman was like totally killing it.
Yeah, Jungleman was killing it.
He was like, was he younger than you at that point?
Or he's like a couple months younger than me.
Right.
Yeah. And yeah, he and I like talked a lot of poker before, so we were good friends online.
He came out of nowhere.
Well, I played him actually when he was at 1020. I played him at 1020 heads up, and I beat him then. But I knew that he was very good.
Yeah.
And you know, I had quit poker. Or, you know, taking a break, essentially, from poker. And at the same time that I had taken a break was when he started really destroying. Mm. So by the time that, like, we talked about it in Vegas, and then he was, like, doing really well at 5,100, 100, 200. By the time that fall rolled around and we ended up actually, you know, living together and moving to Florida to live with Ashton as well, he had taken up the Dirt Challenge.
Oh, right.
So then, like, basically, I was actually...
Was he rolled for that?
He'd sold off a lot of his action.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
The amount of it that he had, he was rolled for. He was making a killing.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he made...
So he was just in the zone.
Yeah. He made, like, $4 million, I think, in 2011.
Wow.
Yeah. No, 2010. Sorry, 2010. He made $4 million. So he was, like, yeah, he was a killer. And I learned a lot from him. And,
yeah.
But also, like, the thing that mostly happened was... You know, when I was living with those guys, I mean, for one...
Was he still a programmer then? Because I know he was, like... I remember reading
I think he was studying computer science. But,
okay.
Like, he was... I mean, he was like us, you know?
Yeah.
He wasn't going to class.
He was like,
He was depressed. He was dissatisfied with school.
Right.
He was going through a lot of the same shit that we were.
Right.
And that's part of the reason why I think he and I bonded really well.
Right.
Like, I kind of saw the same... Like, I kind of saw myself from, like...
Yeah.
You know, a year or two ago in him. And so, you know, I immediately had an affinity for him. And... You know, I mean, he's kind of he's very, very brainy and emotionally disconnected.
Yeah.
And
same thing with Ashman?
No. Ashton is a different beast altogether.
Okay.
His species of crazy is very unique.
Right. He's his like extent is like a physical. He's like a physical guy.
For Ashton, I mean, I know that he's not. I don't believe that Ashton is actually bipolar, but I did. Like, he would very often go through these sort of manic and depressive stages.
Yeah.
You know, and they were very, very visible.
Yeah.
And they were very extreme. Ashton, like, I mean, Ashton is such a weird guy. I mean, he's a very genuine person. And he's very generous, right? And that's one thing that, unfortunately, doesn't do that well for you in the poker world, right? Because if you're a generous person
there's a lot of willing targets for generosity.
Exactly. Very willing recipients.
Right. And what's ironic is the more willing they are, the less deserving they are.
Exactly.
Of generosity.
Exactly. Like that. The thing is, what I learned. So I was somebody. I never really cared that much about money. you know, when I was coming up in the public. I mean, I cared about it in the sense that money was the point, right? Money was the thing.
Sure.
That
no, me. I was the same. It was just like numbers on a screen.
Exactly.
You could take away that dollar sign from the account, from that account balance.
Right.
It would be almost the same thing.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I know both of us were just driving the same fucking car, like, you know, 3 years into to just, you know, starting to make significant money off the
game. Yeah, exactly. The only reason why I have, like, had a better car was because my car broke down.
Right.
And so I took my dad's car and my dad bought a new car. It's like, and that's basically what, that's the car I'm still driving. You know, I never bought a car. Like, I made $1 million in 2010 and I didn't really get anything.
Right.
I was basically living in the same house, same, you know, mediocre car. But the thing that I saw about Ashton and Jungle, which was so fundamentally different, was that they wanted to become, like, they wanted to be acknowledged for their money. You know, and I saw, not at all, but I learned secondhand how hopeless that is. Like, how shitty of a...
Especially as a poker player.
Yeah.
Like...
Yeah, especially as a really, really young guy.
I mean, yeah.
Like, basically, I just saw people continually taking advantage of them. And, like, the thing that... Here's the thing about money. Money, if used in a this sort of, like, naive kind of way, can get you attention, right? It can get you lots and lots of attention, but it cannot make people like you.
Yeah.
Right? It can make people tell you they like you and pretend they like you and be around you and whatever, but it's not going to make people genuinely like you.
Right.
And I saw a lot of that.
Right.
And
barnacles.
Yeah, exactly. And Ashton especially when he was younger, but even as he was, you know, when I knew him in Florida, he was just surrounded by people who... We're like that.
God, that sucks.
Yeah, it
and the
really
the energy on the forums totally encourages.
Right,
that
exactly.
Too.
And I think Ashton, at a certain level, he started to become more and more aware of that, you know. But it was just such an intrinsic part of his personality that Ashton loved being, you know, the center of attention.
Right.
He loved being the hero. He loved being the guy, and he would do what it took to be that.
Did you not want that attention, or did you just didn't really care for it in terms of money?
I mean, I don't think there's anybody who
doesn't want the attention.
Who doesn't want the right kind of attention?
Right.
Right. There's a certain kind of attention. Like, for me,
because since then you've gone on to like write this really like well written blog. You know, you've got this book, obviously.
Right.
It's like,
right.
You know, put in a ton of time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you've kind of remade yourself as somebody that is. You know, a communicator,
right?
And that's almost seems like a different sort of attention because it seems like a two-way street.
I mean, it's kind of my goal is to really deliver value to whoever it is that's reading my blog, and you know, so primarily my audience is poker players and a few non-poker players, and so I try to cater to that audience and write stuff that I think is going to be valuable for them,
right?
But at the same time, like I think my personality is still fundamentally the same as it was underneath all that, right? Like I would. If I never had to use Facebook again or Twitter and I could get all the benefits from them just magically, if someone, you know, snapped a finger, I would be totally down in a second. I would throw all that away in a fucking second. But unfortunately, this is just, you know, this is 21st century culture.
Yeah.
I'm a Luddite basically trying to adapt to 2014.
Oh, goodness.
And so I know it's not good. But like,
that's a tough job.
I know it's not a good gig. But, you know, when I was a poker player, like, even using stuff like AIM or Skype to talk to people, like, I would hate it when people mess.